This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, former poet laureate Natasha Trethewey, says the landscape of her childhood was overwritten with monuments to and symbols of the Confederacy. She was born in Mississippi in 1966 on Confederate Memorial Day, with Confederate flags waving in the streets as Klansmen celebrated. The last home she lived in with her mother was in a suburb of Atlanta on Memorial Drive, where from their home they could see Stone Mountain, the largest Confederate monument in America that's been described as a Confederate Mount Rushmore, with sculpted images of Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson. Trethewey's mother was black. Her father was white. When they married in 1965, interracial marriage was illegal in Mississippi where they lived, so they eloped in Cincinnati. They returned to Mississippi, although it was even illegal there to have married interracially in another state. After Trethewey's parents divorced, her mother married a man who ended up tormenting Trethewey and beating her mother, threatening her with death. He followed through on that threat 35 years ago and murdered her with two bullets, one in the neck, one in the head. Trethewey was 19. Over the years, Trethewey has written poems about her mother, but now she tells the story in a memoir titled Memorial Drive. Trethewey is now the Board of Trustees Professor of English at Northwestern University. Natasha Trethewey, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back again.
Thank you.
A really beautiful, very sad book, but so beautifully written, and I'm glad to have the occasion to talk with you again. I'm sorry that the occasion for the book is such a sad one. You know, you had written poems about your mother in the past, and you were on before on our show, and we'd spoken about her murder. But this book has documents that were saved by the police, and one document that the police found in your mother's briefcase, and that was used as evidence. Tell us the story of how you came to have these documents 20 years after the fact.
It was such a chance encounter. I had moved back to Atlanta in 2001 to take a job at Emory University. And in 2005, my husband and I were walking downtown Decatur to a restaurant that we frequented. And a man saw us and came over and asked if we had been walking from the hotel. And I said no, because we'd been walking from our home, not thinking that he might have meant in the vicinity of the hotel. It turns out that he was the first officer on the scene the morning my mother was murdered and recognized me. And so he struck up a conversation with us and told me that the police departments usually expunge the records. They clean out their files after 20 years. And so they would be getting rid of this file of my mother's case, and he offered to get it and give it to me.
And if you hadn't gotten it, those documents would have been destroyed.
That's right. And I would not have ever had the opportunity to read my mother's last words, in which she is describing her life and getting away and how she understood the effect of being with her former husband on me, the document that she left in her briefcase.
Would you mind reading an excerpt of that? I know it must be a little bit hard to do that because it is your mother's last message, but there's an excerpt I'd like you to read, and there's a reference in this excerpt to your half-brother, your brother who your mother had with your stepfather.
The beginning of the end started in the fall of 1978 when I changed jobs. Not to imply that there had not been trouble during the other 9 years. I was thankful when it was a hole punched in the wall or beaten into a cabinet with a hammer. My physical damage over the years ranged from black eyes, a hairline fracture of the jaw, to bruised kidneys and a sprained arm, all for things he thought about. I quickly learned to gauge his moods and became a master at diffusing him. One of our problems was my successful employment. While he enjoyed the things my income allowed us to purchase, he was jealous of my success. The new job came about as a surprise to me. I discussed thoroughly with him that my new duties would entail travel, some overnights and occasionally long hours, and we decided that I should take it. The other major problem was my daughter from a previous marriage. He insisted that I loved her more than our son, and while he was not overtly cruel to her, he managed to do little things to keep her upset. If I attempted to intervene, it only made matters worse. She spent most of her preteen years in her room. At work, I became a master at scheduling that would keep me out of town as little as possible. My coworkers soon learned not to invite me to happy hours or any activities after office hours because I always had an excuse. I had an excuse for myself, too. My children needed me. There would be time for activities later. While this wasn't 100% true, I knew I could never depend on my husband to be there when I needed him. Finally, in the summer of 1983, I started doing things after 10 years. Each time I did, my husband's reaction grew worse. His accusations and threats increased, and for the first time, he had a gun.
Did you know he had a gun?
I did not. She was able to keep most of what was happening in that house from us. But for me waking in the night and hearing him abusing her, she kept a very stoic facade and kept me from knowing that his threats included us, the children.
You know, in this passage that you read, he threatens her in part because he thinks she loves you, her child from her first marriage, more than she loves her son that she had with your stepfather. Did you have any idea that that was an issue for him in the marriage, for your stepfather?
I thought that the issue was that my father was my white parent, and that he was somehow angry about that. My father was also, like my mother, educated, and I thought perhaps he was more, he was jealous also of the level of education that they both had, that he, with a technical college degree, did not have.
But you didn't know that he was jealous of you?
No, I didn't know that he thought my mother loved me more than my brother. It because she never did anything that made that seem possible. She seemed to love us equally.
You learned from the transcripts that he had considered killing you and that he'd actually been following you so he could shoot you. Can you read an excerpt of the 12-page message that she wrote in which you learned that?
Sure. This is a part of the statement that my mother gave to police on Valentine's Day of 1984, the first time he tried to kill her. He drove down Memorial. As we neared 285, I told him it would be quicker to take me to work to go straight down Memorial. He took 285 south to Covington Highway, exited, then turned around to get back on 285 north and exited at Memorial. We drove down Memorial to the Cinema 5 Theater. He turned in there and drove back to my apartment. He told me to go in, call my office, and tell them I would be in, but in a half an hour. He listened with his hand on the cord to disconnect if I said anything else. Then he told me to sit down. I did, on the couch, and to remove my coat. During all of this time, it was now 7:50, he had to make sure my kids had gone to school before we came back. He was talking about hurting someone close to me. He named my daughter, not his daughter, and my mother. He said he had been following her, my daughter. He had previously told me he was following me, too, and could shoot her any time.
What was your reaction when you read that?
I had known for a while that even before we escaped from him, that he had followed me. If I had to leave home to go to school for a practice of some kind, gymnastics practice or cheerleading practice, or even to meet a friend to go to the movies together, he would often follow me. And I would see him frequently like that. And I just learned to ignore it so that the friends I was with wouldn't realize that this strange person was actually following me. So it wasn't completely surprising to know that he, in the aftermath of us getting away, was following me also. I mean, in fact, the week we left, the first thing he did was find me because she was at a shelter and he couldn't find the location of the shelter, but he knew I'd be at the high school football game on a Friday night with the other cheerleaders.
And describe what you did when you saw him.
Well, I was down there on the track with the rest of the cheerleaders, and he came in and walked all the way down to the front of the bleachers and sat there right in front of me. And when it was impossible for me to ignore him anymore, I looked at him and smiled and waved and spoke a little greeting. And he stayed there for a while, and then finally he left, but he told a psychiatrist or a psychologist at the VA hospital later that he had shown up at the football stadium to kill me, to punish my mother, but hadn't done so because I had waved and spoken a greeting to him.
Do you think he might have shot you had you not waved and smiled?
I've lived with the survivor's guilt of that moment ever since, because I think that had he killed me then, he would have been arrested for that, and she'd be the one alive today.
Would you like to take a break here?
No, I'm okay.
It must be so hard for you to have written this book and read those documents. I mean, it sounds from your book like you really tried to forget a lot of this because it was just too painful to remember, and now, like, you've totally immersed yourself in the story, in the transcripts, and now I'm asking you to retell it, and other people are asking you that too. So I apologize for, you know, putting you through it again.
You know, it feels like a, strangely, a mixed blessing, because as you say, yes, I tried to forget so much of it because it was just a life I wanted to leave behind. I wanted to forge a new life for myself that didn't include that past. But of course, that was impossible. In trying to forget, I realized that I forgot or let go of a lot of her. Parts of our lives together in those years that I would love to be able to remember. And so when I talk about her now, as painful as it is to go back to that place of willed amnesia, to try to recover it, I do find some happiness in bringing back what few parts of her that I can.
In forgetting, you probably also lost a part of yourself.
I suppose that must be true. I think perhaps the person I was before her death might be somewhat unrecognizable to me, at least parts of that person.
When you found out that your mother was murdered, you went back to her home. You were in college at this point and living out of town. And on TV, you saw footage of you entering your home with a caption underneath saying, "Daughter of the Murdered Woman." From your memoir, it sounds like that was a really upsetting and haunting experience for you to see that.
Oh, it felt, in the idiom, to be beside oneself. Because there I was in a hotel room that the police put us up in to hide because they hadn't captured Joel yet. And we turn on the TV and I can see the moment that my grandmother, father, and I arrived at the apartment to take some of her things, to get the clothes she'd be buried in. We got there and there was a news van and police tape over the door. I think people have seen this again and again, this sort of kind of looping footage of the people either giving an interview, grieving right there for the TV cameras, or walking into their home. We did not talk to them, but they captured that scene of me going into the apartment and shutting the door behind me. Looking at it felt like I was watching somebody else. And I think that that's probably the moment that I had decided somehow, consciously or unconsciously, to separate myself from the person to whom this horrible thing had just happened, as if I could move forward in my life without that part coming with me too.
That refers to what you were saying before about trying to forget the whole thing. I mean, you couldn't really forget it, but to try to not think about it, to try to just move forward.
When I was at the police station that morning, the assistant district attorney, Bob, who gave me the file, the man who had been the first police officer on the scene, he told me that he saw me there and that I looked as if I were already far away from this. And when he told me that, I thought it was the strangest thing, because certainly I was in shock. And what he was witnessing was the look of shock on my face. But then I thought, maybe he was right, too, that I was already putting as much distance as I could between that and my future.
He was sentenced to life, but he was recently released after 34 years in prison.
He actually had two consecutive life sentences, eligible for parole after 20 years. So he started going up for parole the first time in 2005.
So he's out on parole now?
Yes, he is.
You don't live in the same state that he does?
No. Fortunately, I moved away from Atlanta in 2017.
Yeah, you taught at Emory University in Atlanta for years.
That's right. Yeah.
So do you feel at all threatened now, knowing that he is out of prison?
I think I would feel much differently about this if I lived in Atlanta, because he would be in the same world that I inhabit. I feel far away from that here. It's hard to answer, but, I have a poem called Letter to Inmate, and it's his inmate number that I wrote when I first found out he was going to get out. And I asked the question at the end of the poem, what does it mean to be safe in the world? Everywhere I go, she is with me, my long dead mother. Is there nowhere I might go and not find you there too?
Wow.
So even if he's not physically here, there is a way that the past enters my life, all of it, and I carry it with me.
And you carried it with you when you won the Pulitzer Prize, and you carried it with you when you were named the U.S. Poet Laureate. So, two extremes, this incredible recognition and success, your gift, your talent, and also this tragedy that you carry with you all the time.
Well, I think it is what made me. I think about Lorca's idea of Duende, the wound that never heals. And in trying to heal the wound that never heals, he wrote, lies the strangeness in an artist's work. This is a wound I carry that never heals, but it is the very thing, that kind of awareness of death, of that possibility, that undergirds everything I do.
Has it prevented you from experiencing joy?
No, actually, I think it makes me experience joy at a much more intense level. To know such grief means that when you experience joy, you know the depths of its opposite, and that makes it that much sweeter.
Well, Natasha Trethewey, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for sharing some of your life with us. I wish you good health during the pandemic and peace of mind.
Thank you. I wish you the same, Terry. It's been lovely to talk to you as always, even if it's difficult material.
Yes.
Thank you.
Natasha Trethewey's new book is called Memorial Drive, A Daughter's Memoir. Drummer Art Blakey led his band, the Jazz Messengers, for almost 40 years, making many classic recordings with top musicians. A newly unearthed 1959 Blakey session has been released. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead likes it a lot.
Trumpeter Lee Morgan on the fast blues Jimmerick. That's from the album Just Coolin', belated new music from drummer Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. This 1959 session went unreleased till now because a couple of months later, the same quintet recorded most of the same tunes for live albums issued instead. Both spirited volumes of the live Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers at the Jazz Corner of the World let the band flex and stretch. But this compact, more crisply recorded studio session is a gem. The band's frontline paired two players who already got along, 20-year-old trumpet phenom Lee Morgan and gruff tenor saxophonist Hank Mobley. Mobley wrote three of the six tunes, including Hip Sippy Blues. Art Blakey's band epitomized so-called hard bop, a hard-driving, heavily swinging style drenched in the blues. The drive mostly came from the drummer. In his prime, Blakey was a great, innovative, and aggressive accompanist. Listen to him lead on Lee Morgan. Blakey draws out the trumpeter's cocky phrasing with all manner of percolating punctuation, including his signature press roll, a quick, forceful roll on snare drum. Ha ha ha! The Jazz Messenger's bluesiness owes a lot to pianist Bobby Timmons, one of the architects of the band's style. He'd recently written Blakey's bread-and-butter song, Moanin'. The nimble pianist mixed earthy phrasing with a bell-like tone. His admirers included even picky Thelonious Monk. One of two new tunes here is Timmons's Quick Trick. On his solo, the horns chime in with a little encouragement. The late 1950s was a golden age for buoyant jazz rhythm sections. One reason was the state of jazz bass playing. By 1959, bassists like this band's Jimmy Merritt could really get around the fingerboard, but they weren't using amplifiers yet, so they had to thwack those strings to make them sing. Merritt's percussive pulse grounds the band, rhythmically and harmonically. Bassist Jimmy Merritt, who passed away in April. Thousands of jazz musicians have tried to recapture this magic, Art Blakey included. When he made Just Coolin' in 1959, he'd been honing this approach for years, and by now had attained a sort of stylistic perfection, even as the band was still developing. And now to have new material by this explosive and short-lived quintet, that'd be good news in any year. Let alone now when we could all use some cheering up.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the new book, Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed Just Coolin', the newly unearthed 1959 session by Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. My guest, Mike Birbiglia, is a comic, writer, actor, and filmmaker, and a contributor to This American Life, who tells personal stories about the kind of experiences and thoughts many people would not want to reveal out of fear of being embarrassed or judged harshly. Birbiglia has done it again in his new book, The New One, Painfully True Stories from a Reluctant Dad. It's about all the reasons he did not want to become a father, how he became a father in spite of that, and all the reasons why he felt he wasn't connecting to his baby daughter and feared his marriage was falling apart. It didn't fall apart. His wife, Jen Stein, who writes under the name J. Hope Stein, collaborated on his new memoir, contributing her side of the story through poems interspersed through the book. Their daughter, Una, is now 5 years old. The book ends when she's around 14 months. Mike Birbiglia also made and starred in the films Sleepwalk With Me and Don't Think Twice. He had a recurring role in Orange is the New Black and is now in the Showtime series Billions. His new memoir, The New One, is expanded from his stage show of the same name. Mike Birbiglia, Jen Stein, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the new book. I think it's great. So, Mike, how did you fear your life would change if you had children?
Well, one of the interesting things about putting this material on stage is, and a lot of authors say this, is that it's when you write that you understand how you feel. And so I had this resistance from day one with Jen and really and before that of, I'm never going to have a child. I remember one of my first jokes that ever worked on stage was, I'm not going to have kids until I'm sure that nothing else good can happen in my life. And then I, when I expounded on that in the show, in the book, I broke it down to 7 reasons why I never want to have a child. I, you know, things that include, like, I love my marriage, I love my cat, you know, the earth is sinking into the ocean, all these things. And I just felt so, logically, I felt so correct about all of my reasoning that it really took my wife putting it, I would say, in more emotional terms for me to understand it, which is to say, she heard me out on all those reasons. And she said, I know all of that. And I think you'd be a good dad. And that was sort of a thing that really melted me, because maybe, and I don't know if this is true, maybe underneath all of that was a fear that I wouldn't be a good dad.
When you realized, Jen, that you wanted to have a baby, did you rehearse how to bring it up to Mike, knowing that he might be resistant to the idea?
I didn't rehearse it, but I just know him so well, so I knew he didn't want to. So I guess, you know, the conversation was like, I know you don't want to have a kid. I totally get it. You're right to feel this way, but I see something different for us. And it was kind of that kind of dialogue.
Mike, did you feel betrayed? Like, we had an agreement. We weren't going to have children. What are you pulling on me now?
Well, I make the point that when she first brought it up, I said to her, I was very clear when we got married that I never wanted to have a kid. And I say, which, by the way, gets you nothing. Apparently being very clear is useless. But it's true. Like, I think it ended up being a series of conversations, I'd say, over months and months. I think I say in the book, like, there was never a moment. There's never a moment in life that creates one big decision. I think it's a series of moments that form an evolution. And I think that's what happened, is over time, I just felt like, well, this is my life partner. This is this person who I love and trust and who I'm going to spend the rest of my life with. And this is really what she wants to do. And I know she'd be a great mom. And so the idea of holding her back at a certain point felt it felt very selfish to hold her back from that. And it was a dilemma. But then, just to come full circle, it's so funny, like, Una's 5 now, and, you know, sometimes people ask, like, what about when Una gets older and she reads this book and all this stuff? And Jen always laughs at that question, because Una is so doted on by both me and Jen that I think for her it would be inconceivable that we would ever have anything less than 1,000% enthusiasm for having a child. And the other thing is that ultimately where the book lands is at this, you know, I don't want to give this away, spoiler alert, if people really want to experience the book exactly in order, but the end is a letter to my daughter saying to her, like, this book is for you. Like, I want you to read this book, because ultimately it's about being honest. Like, I'm being, you know, painfully and darkly honest, in a way that I think that we should all be to each other, because I think that when you're honest with people who you love, ultimately, even if it's painful in the short term, in the long term, it makes you even closer. And I don't know if Jen wants to speak to that.
Yeah, I'd also say that, you know, Mike voicing all of his concerns for me and the way our relationship works, it actually calms me down, and I don't have to wonder what he's thinking. And I think in relationships, sometimes people keep those kinds of fears to themselves, and you have to half wonder, and the feeling is still in the air, but you can't quite put your finger on it. I don't have to worry about quite putting my finger on it. It's completely, like, vocalized on a daily basis, you know, so I don't have to yeah. wonder where I stand or where things mm-hmm. stand. And there's some comfort to that for me, because I feel like I'm actually not much of a talker. And so for me, it helps me sort of it helps comfort me somehow. And so I don't feel so overwhelmed by Mike saying I don't want to do something and knowing that I do want to do it. I don't feel like we're that far apart because he's so vocal and we can actually talk about it and I'm not wondering about it.
There's a joke in the book where I say Jen is an introvert and I'm an extrovert. An extrovert is someone who gets energy from being around other people, and an introvert doesn't like you. Or she might like you, but she's going to need me to explain why we're leaving the party. But that's, I mean, that the introvert, extrovert thing that Jen is alluding to, it is like in some ways our dynamic. And what she's saying, I think, is true. Like, and it's building on what I'm saying, which is like, I grew up in like a Catholic, like a conservative Catholic upbringing in Massachusetts that was very much the opposite of the way that I write, which is it was very sort of like, don't, you know, very much don't say how you feel. And it leads, you know, that kind of behavior leads to repression. And I feel like I try to reverse that, and maybe I go too far.
Oversharing.
Yeah, exactly.
Jen, you had a difficult pregnancy. You were so thrilled to be pregnant, but you had, in your second trimester, you had a bleeding placenta. Which at first you thought was a miscarriage. So I know you were very concerned through the pregnancy that something could go wrong. And then you found out you had hypermobile hips, which meant that during childbirth, you could possibly dislocate or even break a hip. So I want you to read a poem about the pregnancy. And this is a poem called Magic Trick.
Magic Trick. I bled and bled. I thought of friends who have gone through much worse, and I bled. I thought of women across the world and in our own country who have no medical care, and bled. I thought of blood and its magic trick, flowing cell by cell through time without ever leaving the body. How differently it performs than other liquids. Girl, I whisper to my belly, before they tell me she's a girl. My body may fail you. Sorry. But know this. Your life belongs to you. And our time together, it has already begun.
Thanks for reading that. And that's one of the poems in Mike Birbiglia's memoir. Mike, were you afraid not only of being a father, but afraid of losing the baby, and a fear that Jen might be injured in the process of pregnancy or childbirth?
Yeah, I think that the pregnancy was nerve-wracking throughout. Getting pregnant was challenging. I think Jen can speak to this better than I can, but I feel like the first and second trimester were so challenging, and then there was a point in the third trimester where Jen started. There was a period of time where she was enjoying it, and she started eating like a college freshman, just like hot dogs and ice cream and mayonnaise. And at one point, she's eating like three hot dogs, and she looks up to me and she says, "I feel like I understand you now." And I said, "I think that's a little bit offensive. I think that might be the most offensive thing you've ever said to me." But we really did have like a bonding period in the third trimester, where I feel like, in some ways, Jen's pointed this out before, in some ways we were as close in that third trimester as we've ever been. And but it was scary. I mean, the whole thing was scary, and I was really scared for her. I was scared for Una. It was terrifying.
The baby had trouble sleeping at first, and Jen, you're an insomniac, and Mike, you have a really serious sleepwalking problem. You nearly killed yourself a couple of times. And so you were concerned that you could hurt the baby while sleepwalking. So describe what you had to do to protect the baby from your sleepwalking.
This is something that Jen and I spent a lot of time gaming out, because Yeah, I mean, my last book, Sleepwalk With Me, I talk about how I sleepwalked through, to be clear to the listeners, through a second story window of a La Quinta Inn in Walla Walla, Washington, almost 15 years ago. And so since then, I take medication, I sleep in a sleeping bag. And with Una coming, we decided that I should just sleep in a separate bedroom and sleep in a sleeping bag. And then to make it even more secure, I invented, I mean, it's not trademarked, but it's a sleep sheet that has a hole in it for my head. And then one for Jen, though she never used it. And then I would lock the door, and I actually put a chain lock on the inside so that I couldn't get out, because I was, you know, and then Mazzy, our cat, would sleep in that room with me. And occasionally she would pee in the bedroom that I was locked in a sleeping bag. So it wasn't the best surroundings that period of time.
I also wanted to add to that before Una was born, Mike's sleepwalking was a really sort of big issue in our relationship. And it's hard to explain to people how dangerous it is that he actually jumped through a glass window, that he's capable of. What he's capable of doing in his sleep is very different than what he's like in his waking life. And it's really scary. And I was kind of the person, not in charge of it, but I was like his partner in that. And being so connected to Una, I think, took me away from that for a little while. And I usually had such strong tabs on what's going on with Mike's sleepwalking. And it was just very much a part of my day to day. And I was stretched so thin, I kind of let that go.
So, Jim, what was it like for you? Mike had to lock himself in the bedroom to protect the baby from his sleepwalking, which meant if the baby woke up, it's all on you.
Yeah, and we had agreed on that because of Mike's sleepwalking issues and because he takes medication at night. We had agreed that I would be in charge of everything at night. And so, yeah, I was exhausted and Una was a terrible sleeper. And I didn't really see that coming, you know, in my head. I sort of had this idea. I didn't have a lot of fantasies about having a child. I tried not to like put anything on her, you know, before she's born. But one like idea I had is that she would sleep eventually. Like she would, like I would be able to put her down and do a little work while she's asleep. And it didn't feel like that. It was like I had to hold her all the time. And if I ever put her down, she would scream. So she would just sleep on top of me for a long time. And so that definitely created a lot of distance between Mike and I. And then, you know, he was shooting a film, so during the day he was gone all day. And so I feel like in those months, Una and I, you know, got very close, and Mike hadn't really caught up to the sort of basics of how to sort of raise a baby, you know. So I was really doing most of the things at that point. Diapers, baths, nighttime, everything. So, and you know, and it's not a huge surprise given how he felt about it and sort of all the discussions we had before it, but the actuality of it, you know, created distance between us for sure, because we were growing in different directions.
Mike, how did you start to connect to your baby daughter? What changed things for you?
I feel so silly when I think about this, because it's so simple, is that when she started to talk, I started to understand how she felt. I mean, it's so silly. There's this chapter in the book where I take Una for pizza on the corner, and Una says, "Pee pee," which I think means pizza and also yes. And I would say, I'd say, "Una, do you want some pizza?" And she would say, "Pee pee." I'm such a verbal person. And so I think I'm a decent listener. And so I could really listen and understand her. And I still can. Like, she and I are so close now. We just talk and talk and talk. And the verbal communication for me was really profound. And I think for Jen, it was the physical relationship was their version of talking.
Though they can talk now too.
No, I've cut that off.
Cut that out, yeah.
No, now that I have the upper hand, I've really taken over.
Well, I'm so glad you collaborated on this book. I want to thank you both so much for talking with us and for being so open. And I wish you good luck during this COVID crisis and good luck with parenting and Mike with all the work that's on hold right now that will hopefully resume in the not too distant future. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Stay safe.
Thanks so much, Terry. We really appreciate it.
Mike Birbiglia's new memoir, The New One, includes poems by his wife, Jen Stein, who writes under the name J. Hope Stein.